Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Joined in the studio by a special guest. Rocket the cat is here.
Oh, good. Our producer.
Yes, our producer is a cat.
So last week on Misconduct, we discussed the murder of 10 women in South Los Angeles that spanned over 20 years. Little was done on the part of LAPD to investigate and solve the killings that had been tied together with the same gun since the 80s and tied together with an unidentified DNA match since 2005. In 2010, a controversial familial, hard time saying that, DNA search was conducted on the statewide felons database and returned a hit on a male relative. This gave police a hit on a potential suspect pool for the first time during the investigation. This week, we will discuss how the police identified and arrested the man who eluded capture for over 20 years.
Right. So, on July 5th, 2010... LAPD had zeroed in on the person that they believed was responsible for all these slayings that had taken place in South LA. And they, you know, as we know, dubbed him the Grim Sleeper. So once the DNA, partial DNA match had kind of drew a family tree, they zeroed in, they got the hit on Christopher Franklin and drew his family tree, zeroed in on his dad. And his name is Lonnie David Franklin Jr. It's a little bit of a tongue twister for me. He was headed to John's Incredible Pizza in Buena Park for a family party, and he was being tailed by LAPD detectives. They had been waiting for the perfect opportunity to try and get some of his DNA so they could conclusively match the DNA found on the victims to him. They're basically suspect. And one LAPD officer, disguised as a busboy, went into the party room. It's, John's Incredible Pizza is like a Chuck E. Cheese for teenagers.
Right.
Yeah. Arcade games. I had a birthday party there once.
Oh, did you?
I did.
Oh, no way.
In Chino. He dressed up. They had an LAPD officer dress up like a busboy and go in and basically take his plate from him, clear his plate, like as if he was just cleaning up.
Yeah.
There's like footage. Security camera footage that you can find
of, the sting of it operation.
And like I said, it reminds me of a Law and Order episode.
Totally
like,
does.
They like undercover, like, this is your time to shine, man. Go in there, you get that pizza crust. So
you got this, John. You got this.
You can do this. So basically they bagged the pizza crust and sent it off to the lab. 2 days later, LAPD descends on Lonnie's home in South LA. They bring the cavalry out. And they do the whole show.
Shock and awe.
Yeah, shock and awe. You know how they tow those trailers with like forensic evidence or forensic tools and stuff to collect evidence? They bring it all. He's arrested and charged with 10 counts of murder. So let's talk about who he is, just because, you know, he eluded capture for so long. And now we finally have a name and a person and a background. So Lonnie David Franklin Jr. was born August 30th, 1952. He was born and raised in the South LA neighborhood he was arrested in. He was raised in the house that he lived in. It was his parents' house before it was his. He served in the military in the 1970s before heading back to LA, where he got married and raised two children. His wife's name is Sylvia Franklin. She worked for LA Unified School District in the superintendent's office. And as far as I know, she still works there. She might have since retired, but the time she worked there, and she worked there as he was arrested in the subsequent pretrial and trial phase. Mm. At the time he was arrested, he had 15 previous convictions with no DNA evidence collected. Now, to 15. Be fair, right. And we discussed last week how when you're arrested for a felony charge, you're supposed to have your DNA taken. To be fair, some of these arrests may have preceded the 2004 cutoff when they started doing that. So he may have been arrested for a felony before that.
Right.
But I believe he was arrested since then, this charge notwithstanding. But some of the things that he had been arrested for were theft, battery and assault, and false imprisonment.
He had a record.
He had a record that went back.
Yeah.
And we'll find out how far it goes back. Actually, it goes back farther than they originally believed. Interesting note, he actually worked as a mechanic for the LAPD, and he also worked for city sanitation. And because of this, he was at the time, because he was retired when he was arrested, but he still is collecting pensions from the city of Los Angeles from behind bars.
Wow. So let me talk about the pension thing. How does that happen? Like, wouldn't that be one of the first things to go?
I thought maybe it would. I mean, I don't know how that works. Like, I guess you still get your pension. You put in the work, so you get your pension.
Yeah. You killed 10 people.
It seems.
But, okay, fair enough. But what's a bit more troubling to me is, how did he get a job
with the LAPD?
With the LAPD in the city. I mean, so once upon a time, I wanted to actually be in law enforcement.
And I remember this.
Yeah, and I know we're, 20 years later or whatever, but I went through a very rigorous background check because right. I wanted to be a dispatch.
Yeah.
So I go through the same background check as, I went through, take that back, I went through the same background check as a police officer would. Now, okay, maybe a mechanic for the police department or for this, working for the city, you may not have that intense of a background, but if he had 15 prior arrests and he still managed to get a job, not only with the city, but with LAPD. I mean, again, I know things weren't necessarily digitized, but they still had a record and nothing was like, how did that happen?
I think it's just another like egg on the face for the LAPD.
Right.
I mean, he's
right there.
He's works with you, you know? So that was just kind of, I remember being, there's so many parts of this case where I'm just like floored a little bit.
It's very, flabbergasted, like, right? You're like, what is happening? I feel like I'm taking crazy pills.
But besides that, he was actually, in terms of just where he lived, he was a well-known fixture in his neighborhood. A lot of people, when they talked about him, he was considered to be nice and helpful, actually, even. If you needed something, you asked him for it, and you didn't ask how he got it, but he could help you out.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people were shocked that he was arrested for these crimes. And even though he was considered to be, like, a nice person, people would be like, he's really nice. He's kind of like a dirty old man or kind of like a pervert, but he's nice enough. Like, people overwhelmingly were like, he's nice enough, but he did have kind of a reputation of being
like a pervy old guy.
Kind of like a pervy old guy. Yeah. He carried around pictures of naked women in sexually explicit poses. He had them in his car. He'd have them like on his person, like mostly just like, I like the impression that I got was like porn,
mm-hmm,
or women that he had dated. In kind of a more disturbing turn, police actually recovered over a thousand pictures of women in various states of undress. Some of them look like they're not even conscious. Some of them look like they're dead. Were recovered from his garage, which is where he kind of kept some of his trophies. So as far as I understand, a lot of the pictures that he had around his house or he had in his car were not that graphic,
right,
or disturbing.
Probably just more like,
I got the impression it was more like porn. Almost.
Yeah. Just suggestive poses and mm-hmm. dress or states of undress, probably. Yeah.
Police would actually release a collection of 181 photos of women, basically just like a giant grid of them, like mm-hmm. a poster grid of 181 women, asking if anybody knew who they were, because they were unable to identify them. They don't know anything about them, if they're alive and they just had their picture taken, if they are deceased and missing. Mm. To this day, so 6 years later, almost seven, 30 remain unidentified. One of his friends actually said, in hindsight, Lonnie had let him see things almost on purpose. Like, he kept handcuffs in his car, and he would just, like, his friend said that it felt like he was, like, allowing him to see these things, quote, on accident, like, maybe encouraging him almost to ask, like, what is that for? Mm-hmm. So, like I said, handcuffs in his car, a gun that would later be identified as the weapon used in the murders, he saw that too, 25 caliber weapon. Pictures of women in his home, like I said, they'd be scattered around where his wife would be able to find him. And that was notable to his friend because he was saying, you know, his wife was considered to be like a very upstanding citizen. She worked for the school district. She was very active, as from what I gather, in her church.
Right.
And it's not like if she was living in the house with him, it's not like she would not see these pictures on his coffee table.
Yeah, you know. So it's a bit strange that she would, I don't know what the right word is, put up with,
right.
with that.
People thought it was strange that she put up with it, basically. Yeah. They said that it almost felt like he wanted to be caught, or he was, like, encouraging questions.
Yeah, or maybe it was, like, a, I don't know, wanted to show off, maybe, like, you know.
Like, I have the secret that you don't know. Yeah,
like, look what I, you know, it's probably, like, a little, you know, excitement for himself. Like,
maybe something like that.
Yeah, but, you know, maybe if they actually released some of this information 20 years ago, said friend, whether he would have done anything with the info or not, this guy, you know, could have been like, oh, well, I know a guy who, you know, like with Anitra, the surviving victim. She remember he took pictures of her 25 caliber gun. They had a sketch. You know, maybe he would have had a chance to be like, put that together and go, mm-hmm. oh, wow.
Well, oh my God! Yeah,
has a 25 caliber gun. Looks like this guy and has pictures of women.
Right.
So.
Yeah, it's so much like coulda, shoulda, woulda type of on the part of, you know, the LAPD. After his arrest, actually, it was revealed that while he was in the military, so back in the 70s, he was arrested for the sexual assault of a teenage girl in Germany. She was waiting at a train station when a car pulled up with three men in it, including Lonnie, and they forced her into the car and raped her at knife point. And Lonnie took pictures of her, similar to what he did with Anitra in 1988. As far as I could research, he spent some time in the brig. I was having trouble nailing down exactly how much or what kind of the sentencing was.
Yeah, well, I found an article, and he was actually sentenced to 3 years and 4 months.
Oh, okay.
However, he only served less than a year.
Oh my gosh.
And he got a, you know, general discharge.
General,
not dishonorable, not, not honorable. So he had a general discharge from the military.
Like, you weren't really great, you weren't really bad, we're just going to let you go.
Yeah, and okay. So he served less than a year, but the other people involved in the crime, the other guys, they all got 4 years and served their time.
Really?
Yeah. So I just found that kind of interesting, too, that I don't know how it works with the military, but, like...
I don't either.
Yeah, no record of that either.
Yeah, I don't know how that record, like...
I mean, it happened in Germany, I know, right? So...
Yeah, but he was punished within the...
Military
American
law.
Military.
Yeah.
I don't know
so, how but that yeah, works. He did serve less than a year. Sentenced to 3, serve less than a year.
God. He seems, we'll see, kind of to be the, like... luckiest guy in terms of just like circumstances that just work out in his favor like right. this. I mean, it's crazy. The woman though who was assaulted actually came from Germany to testify in his murder trial, which I thought it was nice that she got, you know, a day in court.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess she got, I don't know how, again, military trials work, but you know, she's seeing him serve time.
Yeah,
basically
a bit more justice for her.
As far as the arrest goes, he was, you know, arrested at his home, and the police turned it upside down. During the interrogation, his questioning was so interesting. I ended up finding some YouTube videos online of basically, like, the recording as, like, a camera up in the interrogation room online, and it was so interesting. Again, we'll link it on our website. We'll have all sorts of links for you guys. He seemed very calm. I mean, I guess I don't know, like, are you supposed to, like, freak out or whatever? Yeah. But how do you react, right? But he was polite, too, was the other thing that was notable. He was a little nervous, maybe. Like, he was like, I don't really know why I'm here, guys. Like,
interesting.
It was very weird to see. So, it's hard to hear what he's saying in the video. It's a lot easier to hear what the police are saying, but you can kind of see his demeanor. They're telling him, you know, we have all these women. They're showing him pictures. They're flipping over pictures of their faces.
Yeah.
And showing them, you know, we have your DNA on this woman's body and this woman's body and this woman's body. And he acknowledges the connection. Like, wow, that's really strange. I don't know who they are, though. Just keeps saying that over and over again. Very calm, cool, and collected. Even kind of lightly jokes with them. Huh. Like, I'm sorry for wasting your time, guys. Kind of like that. Like, yeah. You know, like, it's just like, it was just very strange to watch. I, to be fair, have not watched a lot of interrogations, so I don't really know how that normally plays out, but that was interesting to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, you have him dead to rights, really. I mean, we have
right. DNA. That's what they told him. They said, yeah, we have you dead to rights. And he was like, I don't know anything about it.
Yeah, I don't know how that got on there. That's weird.
Yeah. You know? And so most of the interrogation focused on the why did you do this, not did you do this? Because, you know, with the discovery of all the women's photos in the home, it became clear that they might be looking at more victims and, again, have no leads to go on.
Mm-hmm.
So he still refused to talk and ends up lawyering up, and that kind of ends the interrogation. That brings us into the pretrial phase. Now, I'm going to go into detail about the pretrial because it was so lengthy and so interesting, and just like kind of how the American criminal justice system works.
Yeah.
I condensed it down because it was a five and a half, six year pretrial phase.
Yeah.
So from 2010, when he was arrested and arraigned, he ends up going to trial in 2016.
Wow.
So he's represented by a pro bono legal team. He has several lawyers that are representing him for free, basically.
Yeah. Well, they're like, ooh, big case.
Big case. I'm going to make my name, you know, I want my name on this case type of a thing. He's arraigned a month after he's arrested. So August, 2010, and he enters a not guilty plea to 10 counts of first degree murder and the one count attempted murder of Anitra Washington. The pretrial begins, and the main defense tactic is just delay, delay, delay. Let's delay the trial as long as possible. The theory and the thinking behind this is that as time went on, family members and witnesses are getting older. Mm-hmm. They're not remembering. They're unfortunately passing away in some cases. And they might not live to see the trial, so they actually might be able to poke holes in the case, right? Franklin himself was almost 60 when he was arrested. And the stepmother of Barbara Ware, who was murdered in 1987, her name is Diane. She becomes a fixture kind of in the trial proceeding, the pretrial proceedings. She was almost 70 when Franklin was arrested. And Barbara Ware's father actually passed away not knowing what happened to his daughter and not being able to see the outcome. Diane would travel more than an hour each way on public transportation to attend every hearing and every pretrial, whatever, for years. And she would express her concerns to the press often that, you know, as the delay started to become really weary on the family, like, I'm afraid that I'm not going to be able to live to see this through. What I want to do is be able to live to see this through.
Yeah.
Because she's almost 70 when she's arrested. She's going to be pushing late 70s today.
Yeah.
And Franklin's lawyers, you know, they had some very interesting tactics for delays. Most of the delays were related to the defense not having enough time to process the evidence. So because of this and all the delays and all the requests, the prosecution, the defense bumped heads a lot in court.
Yeah,
they would get pissed at each other.
Mm-hmm.
The first major delay would be in June of 2011. They get a one-month delay where the defense criticizes the LAPD for releasing the photos of the women found in Franklin's home in an attempt to identify some of them, basically saying that that was unfairly tainting the jury by releasing all this information to the public.
Right.
They also requested more time because they said that they weren't done going through the evidence. And again, to be fair, this is evidence going back 20 plus years.
Right.
Hundreds of pieces of evidence, multiple victims. At that pretrial hearing in August 2011, the defense is granted more time because now they want to hire an independent ballistics analyst to go through the gun evidence. Mm-hmm. And so these small delays, like it's like at each trial, it's like, actually, now we want to do this. And then they do another hearing. Actually, now we want to do this.
And
we
each time it's going to push it out a month or two.
And it pushes it out a month, 2 months,
and that adds up very quickly.
That basically goes on until August of 2013. So 2 years later. So we're 3 years post-arrest, and the family is fed up with the stalling tactic. Many of them are speaking to the press at this point. Like Barbara Ware's stepmom, like I said, she's concerned. She's, you know, she's losing hope that they're going to go to trial that year. She's mm-hmm. like, we're looking at a 2014 trial date now, in August of 2013.
Right.
So in December 2013, the defense is granted a 6-month delay, which pushes you into mid-2014 at minimum. They asked for permission to independently photograph over 900 pieces of evidence. And at this point, the judge is getting really fed up with the defense because she sees the game that's being played.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, at some point, we're going to have to just get on with this. She took them to task over the delays. And she said, you know, I'm really going to start cracking down on this. In January 2014, and then this was the objection from the defense that I was waiting for. The judge rules the DNA evidence collected at John's Incredible Pizza in July 2010 admissible in court. That seems like, to me, one of their Hail Marys, because that was obviously a huge point of contention, in my opinion.
Yeah, but what's kind of interesting is, you know, you have all these little delays. Like, they're bringing up all these things, and the judge, you know, is like, stop it.
Yeah, the
and
judge then, is like, come on.
Then they go for the DNA, which is something you probably would have to stop and talk about.
Oh, yeah, you would be, like, negligent if you didn't.
Yeah, so yeah. It's like, hey, he's kind of smart, too, I hate to say
oh,
it.
Oh, he's... really smart defense attorney.
Yeah.
He's the defense attorney I would want,
mm-hmm.
At least so far. The defense challenges this decision for two reasons. First, they said that the plates were cleared from him, like the busboy slash undercover LAPD officer
mm-hmm.
took the plate from him before he was done. So, like, just went up and, like, snatched it from him.
Yeah.
Didn't
ask for it back, did he?
Therefore, it was taken from him illegally. An illegally pizza crust illegally seized. also, the second reason that it was contested was Franklin says that he should have had a reasonable expectation of privacy, basically, that the plate would be taken and thrown away with the rest of the trash.
Really? You think about your trash? Your pizza
I don't
crust?
Generally think about where
yeah,
my trash
really...
goes in a restaurant. He says that he thought it would be thrown away in the trash and mixed together. Therefore, you would never be able to be like, pick his pizza crust out of
the, all the other yeah. ones. Yeah.
Moral of the story is you should all eat your pizza crust. I'm just kidding. Franklin.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And he actually said, in again, there's a video of this online, he said... I felt like it would be mixed in with the rest of the trash. And you can hear the exasperated sighs
mm-hmm.
from all the family members in the courtroom. And the judge basically rolled her eyes. She told the defense that they're ridiculous. Quote.
Yeah.
No reasonable person would think about where their trash went if they didn't think they were under surveillance. So yeah. That's what she said. So basically, he lost his expectation of privacy once the plates were taken from the table.
Yep.
So that was the big, big piece of evidence that I was wondering how the defense was going to challenge that and what ruling was going to be made. I think the prosecution was also like, they need that evidence.
Yeah, that's... that's their whole case, that evidence, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And then, so... delays keep coming and take you straight through 2015, a whole year later, basically, after the whole DNA admissibility argument. Prosecutors cite Marcy's Law to try and force the trial forward. Now, Marcy's Law is a voter-approved amendment to California's Constitution. It was voted in 2008, which is essentially a victim's bill of rights. So... the same federal right that everyone in the United States is granted the right to a speedy trial. So they can't arrest you and arraign you for something and then just sit you in jail for years. That same right is given, extended in California to the victims.
Mm-hmm.
And again, to prevent the defense from doing, from
exactly
prolonging,
what's going on.
Prolonging exactly what is going on. Trying to prevent, you know, pain and suffering from the family who have to take time off of work. The family testifies at the hearing that they're suffering emotionally and the trial interferes with their life because they want to be there for the hearings.
Right.
And, you know, a few times a month they're having to get down to downtown Los Angeles and relive, you know, one of the most horrible
moments,
things that may have happened to them in their lives. Like, so they basically ask the judge to move the trial forward so they can start to move on. Because they haven't even gotten into the trial yet. So the judge rules that jury selection is going to start in 2015. And that the trial itself is going to start in 2015. And she lays down the law and she's like, this is, it's going to start.
Yeah, it's happening.
We're doing it.
Yeah. Like,
in September 2015, the defense pulls a maneuver which... requires the prosecution to request a 3-month delay. So less than a month before the trial date, I think it might have been something like 2 weeks before the trial was supposed to start, the defense provides a list of potential DNA that may have been present at the scenes based on their own processing of the evidence that casts reasonable doubt that maybe somebody besides Lonnie was at the crime scene, forcing the prosecution to have to vet that evidence, because if not, then that creates reasonable doubt and then they can't
the
convict
case falls
him
apart. Yeah,
without that's a reason, beyond a reasonable doubt.
I don't hate to say it. I take that back. I think, you know, everybody's entitled to a vigorous defense, and that's pretty smart.
And that's vigorous, yeah. I would say.
That's smart making the prosecution do it, though. I mean, just one more time,
just like a
one
a
more delay
big fuck you to the prosecution.
It is, yeah.
And at this point, the judge is pissed. And she reams the prosecution, she reams the defense. She accuses them of sitting on this evidence and pulling it out when they needed it just to get a last minute delay. She called the lead defense attorney a liar, claiming, because he said, you know, I didn't willingly mislead anyone. And she said, you're a liar. So that is a 3-month delay into the end of 2015. And then... the defense had one more in them. In November of 2015, the second chair of Franklin's defense, her name was Luisa Pensanti, she was ruled not eligible to practice by the state bar in California because she did not pass an ethics exam she was supposed to take because she was brought up on accusations of professional misconduct. Unrelated to this case.
Right.
And she was basically like, you need to go take this course and this test
mm-hmm.
if you want to keep practicing. And she didn't do it, so her license to practice law expired.
Accidentally. Forgot to do that, huh?
Yeah, I guess so. Finally, January 2016, jury selection begins. And then on February 16th, 2016, the trial begins. So...
6 years.
6 years. It's, yeah, like 5.5. But yeah, basically.
Yeah,
I mean,
6 years. It's
of just little
delay after delay after delay.
Delay here.
Yeah.
Yeah. impressive, to say the least. I was
thinking the exact same word. That's funny. Impressive, actually, though, with the, especially, I think, making the prosecution ask for that last one.
Oh, my gosh.
You know? Because what's the judge going to do? The prosecution hasn't been asking for anything.
And they have to, otherwise their case falls apart. You have to grant it.
You have to. And then whether or not that second chair of his defense let that exam sort of pass on purpose or not, who knows?
I don't think you'll ever know, but interesting to think about.
So great. After 5.5 years, trial begins.
Right.
Yeah.
So we have a jury of 7 women and 5 men, like I said, opening statements on February 16th. The courtroom was packed with family members. The Black Coalition Fighting Back Serial Murders and Margaret Prescott, they're in attendance. I kind of want to break down the arguments, because for as long as the pretrial phase was, the trial itself was like 3 months long, if that. It might have been less. So for the defense, for all their delays to vet this evidence so vigorously, they presented a fairly simple case. They presented a theory of a mystery man that was actually responsible for the murders. They didn't provide a name for this other suspect. They didn't provide any evidence that implicated somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
They just said it must have been somebody else. And then they spent the rest of their time poking holes in the prosecution's case. Franklin didn't take the stand, which means he wasn't cross-examined by the prosecution. But for the prosecution, their argument was interesting. They relied first on the legality of the familial DNA search that they used to draw the family tree to investigate Franklin. And we talked about that in the last episode, just kind of the legal, ethical gray areas around that.
Right.
They also relied heavily on the evidence collected at the pizza place. So that big ruling that where Lonnie Franklin tried to say that his pizza was taken from him against
illegally.
His will.
Yeah.
They relied on the admissibility of that evidence as well. And with that, they kind of have a slam dunk case.
Yeah. Here's his DNA.
Here's your DNA. Here's his DNA. And here's the DNA on the bodies. And it really became a question of, you know, what else do we not know about him? Because we didn't know so much for so long. I also, when I was researching kind of how the case played out, jotted down some other notable things that came out during the trial that I thought were interesting. Evidence that from the prosecution, actually picture evidence that they took from his garage where he had the more like explicit and disturbing pictures.
Mm-hmm.
There were pictures of Anitra Washington bleeding and unconscious in the seat of his Pinto recovered from his house.
Really?
Photos of Janisha Peters, who was the 2007 victim that prompted the creation of the 800 Task Force, were also found in his home. Anitra Washington got her day in court. She got to testify against him, and she positively IDs him in the courtroom as the man who shot her and left her for dead 20 plus years before. Another interesting thing, the trajectory of the gunshot wounds to the victims were consistent with a passenger, someone sitting in the passenger seat being shot by somebody in the driver's seat.
Interesting.
Yeah. That is consistent with the story that Anitra told the police in 1988, that she was sitting in the passenger seat and he shot her. Which again, for all the, you know, what a traumatic event for her to remember all of this so clearly is really amazing. The prosecution also tells the court that the police have reason to believe that there are at least 5 more victims. They don't add them on as extra charges in this trial because they cite, you know, the lengthy pretrial phase.
Yeah.
And respect for the families to not drag this out, let's keep it separate type of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go into the 5. 3 of them had similar MOs. In 1984, Georgia Mae Thomas was 43. She was found shot and killed with the same 25 caliber weapon found in his home. Now, 1984 would be the year before his first victim. His first victim, Deborah Jackson, was found in August 1985. So now we're going
back
further.
Mm-hmm.
Inez Warren, who's 28, and Sharon Dismuke, I hope I'm saying that right, 21, were both found shot and their bodies were dumped in a similar fashion to other victims. Now, these women were found during his, quote, sleeping period. So the stretch between 88 really and 2002. Which brings the question, was he ever sleeping?
Right.
And there's also evidence in his home of two more victims. Relenia Morris is 31, mother of two, when she disappeared in 2005. She's never been found, but her driver's license and a picture of her were recovered from Franklin's home, from his garage. Mm. Ayella Marshall was 18 when she disappeared in 2006. She's also never been found, but her high school ID card was recovered in Franklin's home.
Yeah, it's like, why would he have
right
those two things? Yeah.
This, plus the other unidentified women, lead the police to believe that there are many more victims that we just don't know about, and he may never have actually been sleeping. The bodies just haven't been discovered yet.
Yeah.
So that brings us to the close of the trial. Like I said, it was short. It ends on May 4th, 2016. That's when it goes to jury deliberation. They didn't reach a verdict on day one, but on day two, they return a guilty verdict, 10 counts of first degree murder, one guilty count on, a guilty on the one count of attempted murder of Anitra Washington. And then it goes to sentencing. Now, this was the big thing. Was he going to be sentenced to life in prison, or was he going to be sentenced to death? During the sentencing phase, the jurors heard from the friends and family of the victims for over an hour. Again, there's video of this on YouTube. Many of the family members recounted their favorite memories with their loved ones, and just the overall theme was just the sadness that they were such wonderful people and their potential was never fully realized because they were so young.
Yeah, you took them.
And their lives were cut short, you know, and people missed them so much. There were people who came up there and said, you know, I never met my aunt, whoever, but I've grown up, you know, we've grown up wondering what happened to her. Mm. She's always been kind of present in our household, even though she's been gone for so many years. So... Anitra Washington actually also spoke again at the sentencing, and she, you know, testified and then spoke again. Again, she's a very strong woman.
She's an amazing woman. Yeah. I can't imagine. I mean, and I'm so glad she was able to be there at the trial.
Yeah, see this through.
See it through. Because
same. The defense attorney asked the jury to spare Lonnie Franklin the death penalty. Now, I found his reasoning ironic. Now, regardless of how you feel about the death penalty, right? I'm personally against it.
Yeah.
But he being the defense attorney, asked the jury to consider what the impact of a lengthy and impending execution date would have on the families and the victims.
That's got some gall to say that, given
the six-year delay.
Six-year delay you put trial? Them through yeah. pre-trial. Yeah.
Yeah, I found that ironic. I mean, you have to... ask, of course, but I mean,
yeah, but really,
see, I don't know if I'd be able to do that and look people in the eye and be like, so
you don't want to put them through a lengthy, you know, death penalty right. appeals, and really, it's just like a lengthy pretrial that you
yeah,
did.
I would, yeah, hmm. God,
he's a defense attorney doing his job, though. I will say
it is,
I
mean, yes, it yeah. is. And we do need that. Mm. So, June 6th, 2016, the jury recommends the death sentence for Lonnie Franklin Jr. So again, recent. So recent.
Yeah.
He's formally sentenced to death on August 10th, 2016. Now, that will be 31 years to the day that Deborah Jackson's body was discovered in 1985. Wow. At the sentencing, all the victims' names were read out loud to the court, which I thought was kind of nice. You know, they yeah. went kind of ignored for so long that they do finally get their day
of acknowledgement yeah.
in court. Death row inmates in California are all incarcerated at San Quentin State Prison in Marin County. So.
I didn't know that they're so yes. all death row.
Yeah, executions take place there too, actually. So okay. he's going to spend the rest of his life in San Quentin.
Yeah. Side note, not too far from us.
No, just yeah.
across the
just
bridge.
A little jaunt across the bay.
Yeah.
We also just wanted to read the list of victims again because I think for so long they went. You know, ignored.
Mm-hmm.
And so we could just have one more list of them again. Yeah. We had Deborah Jackson, Henrietta Wright, Barbara Ware, Bernita Sparks, Mary Lowe, Lucretia Jefferson, Alice Alexander, Anitra Washington, Princess Berthamew, Valerie McCorvey, and then Janisha Peters. So, leading into our final thoughts, I have so many.
This case is so, it's frustrating and interesting, and I'm glad he's
frustrating.
Frustrating again. But just the fact that LAPD just completely, in my opinion, did nothing.
Bombed.
Did nothing. I think
you had one job.
Yeah, you had one job, LAPD. But I mean, if you just flash back to, you know, I'm just going to keep going back, not only to the, you know, because the women that had died, but you have Anitra Washington,
right,
a survivor, who gave you the most detailed account. You had a car. You had a sketch. You had
the bullets.
Yeah, and you did nothing with that. Absolutely nothing for 20 years. Not even a sketch. You couldn't even just throw the sketch out on TV and go, has anybody seen this man?
Right.
You know, could they have caught him? You know, but maybe they didn't try is the problem.
I truly believe that if this had been investigated, if, you know, Newport Beach, this is happening in Newport.
Right.
Or, you know, 20 miles north, 20 miles south, whatever. You're going to see maybe not as many victims, because I think it would have been investigated a little more vigorously, and they may have been able to catch on to leads that then went cold and became useless because it didn't really, you know, go anywhere at the time. You know, time passes and, you know, leads get, you know, narrower and narrower, basically.
Right. Yeah.
I don't think there would have been as many victims. I mean, you can't say for sure.
And there's a reason why he picked that area to, you know, I mean, it's kind of interesting. I mean, some people would say you don't want to, you know, you wouldn't do that in the area that you live. It's kind of, but obviously he knew he could, because these cases aren't getting investigated.
He did it for years, decades without getting caught.
Yeah, he knew he could get away with it because the police aren't going to, you know, do anything about it.
Right.
Clearly.
Yeah.
They clearly haven't. You know, so I don't know if it was investigated properly from day one. Gosh, I mean, honestly, though, you can go all the way back to the military.
Yeah.
The fact that he raped someone in Germany and he spent less than a year in jail, like, and then they put him back on the streets, pretty much. I mean,
yeah.
And he went to go flourish in South Central Los Angeles.
Right.
It's, so I don't know. I don't know what you think, but if the case had been properly investigated from day one.
Oh, I don't.
They might have been able to catch him.
I think they might have been able to catch him sooner.
Catch a break, anyway.
Yeah. You wouldn't have to be, you know, 20 years out and not have any lead at all, and then have to conduct this familial database search. And what if that had led nowhere?
Yeah.
What if they didn't have a hit? You know? So that's why I'm so conflicted on the familial DNA search, because on one hand, I'm like, I'm so glad that they caught him. On the other hand, I'm like, this, you know, at what cost type of
it's
thing?
It's a slippery slope.
It's a slippery slope. Like,
I think. Yeah, because it is good. It's good they got him. But,
imagine if they'd investigated it properly on the forefront. Would they, at the beginning, would they have had to go down this road? And you can't rely on that, I don't think. I think it's, again, a slippery slope to rely on just maybe one of their sons, cousins, uncles is in, you know, a database somewhere because he got arrested.
And if we get used to the idea that everybody should be giving up their DNA to the police, no, even if they were just arrested.
Mm-hmm.
It's really
scary.
It is, yeah, because like I said before, I mean, we don't live in a perfect society. We have a Fourth Amendment for a reason.
Right.
The Founding Fathers figured that was a good idea, knowing that we didn't want, and I feel like that is an illegal, you know, search.
Right.
To search you because they found my DNA, but I'm not in the database. But hey, you know, that leads to, you know, Colleen. I mean, you know, just for example, and I don't think that's okay that you're under surveillance all of a sudden, a potential suspect, just because you happen to be related to me. Not to mention you're taking my DNA for something I didn't do wrong. And what was that? 62%, I believe, people who were arrested and had their DNA taken never were charged with anything. So,
yeah, Yeah, it's. I feel like I could go on forever about this.
Yeah, definitely.
In terms of whether or not he was ever actually sleeping, if he's the Grim Sleeper, I don't think so.
I don't think so.
He worked for city sanitation. He had unfettered access to landfills, mm-hmm. I think. I think we just don't know.
The bodies were never recovered.
And they may never be recovered.
Yeah.
I think he got maybe smarter, quote, after Anitra survived, if mm-hmm. he knew she survived. I think he got maybe smarter, a little more careful, wasn't going to just dump people on the street anymore.
Yeah, and L.A. probably, you know, helped him out quite a bit by not even investigating things until later.
Right. And again, you know, working...
Sanitation.
Yep. You can... Yeah, I think that might be, especially in the interrogation, you kind of see, once they see who he is, and they're like, oh my god, we might have, like, a big problem on our hands here. Mm-hmm. In terms of, like, actual true number of victims. So
yeah, I doubt there was a break.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so. But,
yeah,
you know,
unfortunately, especially with the five that the prosecution
brought up.
It's how early was he killing mm-hmm. in South Los Angeles?
Right. Yeah, there's that, too. Yeah, so we're like, oh, we have pre-1985 killing now.
And we have...
Well, 74, right, was just, you know, in the military, too.
In the 70s, yeah.
It's not his first rodeo.
No, I don't think so at all. Which, again, is really unfortunate.
Well, I thought this case, I'm very glad he's in jail now.
Me too.
But it's a hell of a story.
It is.
I'm glad the living family members and Anitra can finally feel like they have some justice after all they've been through.
Same.
With this.
Yeah.
So.
That is kind of the, I mean, it's not a happy ending, but it's, I think, a good ending.
At least
as good
something.
As it can be.
Yeah.
You know?
It's something. So, I think that wraps us up for today. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us. And you can visit our website, misconductpodcast.com, to leave your thoughts and comments on today's case. Any links to further reading and other content, such as the YouTube videos, etc., will be posted below the episode. Misconduct is available on SoundCloud and iTunes. You can also visit our Facebook and Instagram pages. Please visit the website for those links. As always, if you'd like to email suggestions for an upcoming episode, you can do so via the website. We will see you next episode.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.